This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Kia ora and welcome to Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Today's show, Food in the City, is sponsored by Cafe Prima, which is a locally owned and operated roastery in Woolston. And given that the show is all about food sustainability, it's pretty cool to know that if you pop in with your own container, you can get a discount off your beans, the ones that have come direct from the roasteries. Today we're talking food in the city with three guests in conjunction with FESTA, the Festival of Transitional Architecture. And one of the topics I'm going to be interested to explore is why are we talking about transitional architecture and food? But we'll get into that, I'm sure, as we go on. Now, if you guys wouldn't mind introducing yourselves, please, for our listeners.
Kia ora, I'm Chloe Waitatini and I'm a coordinator with the Food Resilience Network in Canterbury.
Kia ora everyone, my name is Bailey Perryman and I'm co-founder, director and manager of Farm Systems for Cultivate Christchurch, an urban farming project.
Great, and is that a series of urban farms or just the one on Peterborough Street?
Yeah, so we're building a network of productive urban farms around Christchurch, and these spaces also serve to support our young people to live lives that they value.
And Chloe, you mentioned the Food Resilience Network, but you're also part of many other things.
Yeah, I'm also coordinating the major project for FESTA this year. So working with 7 different architecture and design schools from around New Zealand and Australia to create 18 different architectural installations. I'm also, as part of my role with the Food Resilience Network, I'm leading the Otakaro Orchard Project, which is an edible park and urban food hub, which is going to be situated along the Avon River between the town hall and the Margaret Mahi playground.
And do we have a sense of a timeline yet for that?
We're hoping that the garden, all the landscaping is going to be done towards the end of the year, and then the building coming in the second half of next year.
Yeah, exciting. All it's going really, well. Yeah. It's really coming together though.
Yeah, we're trying to be one of the most efficient anchor projects ever built in the city so far.
Probably in terms of length of time, I imagine it will
be,
actually.
Yeah, and I really want to show that you can build something really great in a cost-effective and time-efficient way with doing rich stakeholder engagement the whole way through as well. That's really important to me.
I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about these different projects as we go on. And Peter, our final guest.
Yeah, kia ora. Peter Langlands. I've manager New Zealand Wild Capture Foraging Facebook page, and just built up a group of foragers around New Zealand, and just to increase people's diversity of forage foods that we have. And we're pretty lucky in the city here. We've got a really outstanding diversity, and also out on Banks Peninsula next to the city. And I also work in with Ground Food Tours in Littleton, who are involved with the festival this year.
Great, thanks. Well, I guess to get our conversation started, we're talking about food in the city. We've got urban farming, we've got urban foraging, we've got urban orchards, and I guess lots of other things. How do we define an urban farm? What is it as opposed to a normal farm, or is there a specific size? These sorts of things.
It's a good question. The main thing for me is distinguishing it from a community garden, which is something I think people in Christchurch are perhaps more familiar with, and the main point of difference being mostly, not necessarily scale, it's more the intensity of the production that's happening, and that's geared towards adding an enterprise or commercial component that aims to support the majority of the wider social and educational aims and purposes of the project, and also within But the goal which we're testing and working towards at the moment also is to get to a scale where that level of income and the commercial component can meet the majority of our operating costs without having to rely on external funding, which gives us flexibility to operate in a more, I think, in a more innovative and adaptable way.
You mentioned social aims as well?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So these environments that we're creating, first and foremost, we're testing a way of farming that is social, and that's quite a significant challenge, I think, and a game where the urban component meets farming. Where farming, traditionally we think of a family, and in particular a male figure, slogging it out in the fields, and there's a lot of pressure that falls on one individual's shoulders to produce for their community, and is separated from the people that are actually consuming that food. In an urban environment, we can you're much closer to the people who you are, the farmers actually serving, and that relationship is strengthened, and the reality of what it takes to produce our food and what those environments are like becomes much more higher in our consciousness, which I think is really important. Our relationship to food is directly proportional to the degree of health or sickness in our society, which is, as sort of to paraphrase one of my favourite farmers, Masanobu Fukuoka, natural farming pioneer from Japan. But in Cultivate in particular, we are focusing on some of our most vulnerable sectors of the population here in Christchurch, in particular our young people, and especially those who have mental health issues. Yeah. But the farms, and this, the feedback we're getting is the farms are a really safe, supportive, dynamic, positive and energetic place to be for everyone. And so, yeah, I think that's where things, that dynamic with the intensity of the production becomes an intensification and a heightening of the life forces that, and the energy that's moving through that space, then I think that lifts things up a little bit.
And the reason that I ended up working in local food and knowing that that was what I wanted to do is I studied landscape architecture and urbanism and saw that in our 20th century like city making model, we were very disconnected from our communities and from the natural environment, and that was causing all sorts of problems. It was causing problems with health, with crime, with social isolation, and with the research that I was doing at that time, local food initiatives, including farming, community gardening, sharing food together, that was shown to be the most effective activity you can do in community to break down those barriers and to have different kinds of people actually connect and strengthen those local bonds. And so that's how I ended up in this. And of course, having that connection to soil as well, it's so missing in our urban lives and to how things grow. And since I was a kid, I've always, the miracle of putting these tiny little things called seeds in the ground, giving it some water, and then a few weeks later, food comes out. Like, that's a little miracle. I've always been delighted by that, and I think, giving the chance for other people to have that as well. And so community gardens are really important, but also, as Bailey said, being able to have a commercial model that allows that to be financially self-sufficient, because a lot of community gardens, they've got one person that really champions them, and when that person kind of exhausts themselves or whatever, they fall over, and those are really important community assets. And even more so in the aftermath of the quakes, when our food system was really, and food supply was really disrupted, we realised that these community gardens and these productive spaces within our cities within our urban environment were actually really important assets. They weren't just nice to haves.
Peter, I can see you nodding away.
Yeah, no, it's sort of it all resonates with me. As Bailey said, it's really about that sense of connection, and with foraging, there's no better way to tune into the quality of the local environment to go foraging, because you're directly collecting the food, and when you eat the meal, it brings back the memory of where you've been during the day and the people you've been with as well. Had a pretty busy weekend with a couple of foraging tours, so still a lot of memories sort of resonating just from what we've done. But yeah, it's just about that sense of connection with other people, meeting a diversity of people, knowing where your food comes from is a really pivotal part of I think of people's health. And I'm lucky to be involved with Conversations, which is a group, and our main push really is for people to identify where their food comes from, to know the local food producers, the local gardeners. And it really is all about environmental sustainability, and I think that's one of the key things.
I think what seems so nice in what you're saying is it's both environmental and social sustainability. They seem to go hand in hand.
Absolutely, and it's all about that connection, like between ourselves and also to the natural environment around us.
They're the same thing.
Yeah.
You can't separate them.
Yeah, it's all the concept of manaaki, really, of just sense of place, a sense of looking after people, and a sense of community. With something like foraging, which is quite undefined in many ways, it's sort of quite universal. It's great because we've got a sort of big online tribe of people now sharing information with the resources that are out there, and hoping to work in with local government, local regional councils, with identifying some of the more important foraging environments. Just check they're protected from spraying activities and things like that. Several years ago in the drought in North Canterbury, unfortunately we had some really big watercress beds that's ripped out, I think unnecessarily, on a Spring Creek environment. So I think we've really got to work on environmental awareness.
Peter, you mentioned foraging is a wee bit undefined, and I guess that's one of my questions too. Is it kind of as simple as plucking an apple off a tree, or is there something more to it to be categorised as foraging?
Not really. It's pretty universal, Foraging really covers everything, I guess, that gardening, fishing and hunting don't, as far as food gathering goes. It's just everything else in between. So, I met my foraging group yesterday just at a car park in Littleton, and we actually just stopped there and then and had a look, and we found about 25 different types of forage foods, just with some piles of disused soil and a bit of gravel lying around the edge of Littleton Port. So, you can just sort of do it anywhere at any time, really, and, that's what keeps it exciting. I'm building a database of what we've got in New Zealand as far as the species and locations go with foraging opportunities. And for me, being involved with quite a lot of environmental issues, it really ties in a lot of interests. I've got a lot of people, friends who are environmentalists, bird researchers and entomologists and things like that all around New Zealand. So it's really good. We're just mapping out the entire biota, really, and looking at what's ethical and sustainable to eat.
That sounds great, and perfect place to have our first break.
Yeah.
We've got Chloe's song, Marmalade.
Excuses every time, wanted marmalade bagel, they only had jam, so I got a plain bagel and I waited for Sam.
I left at 12:45, I thought it'd be sweet, but the wind was so strong and the rain turned to sleet. The sleet turned to hail and the road turned to foams. I was barking in channels with ice cubes for toast. I cried to the sky and my curse with a spell. Every time I tried to drink I seemed to fall down a well.
Pour me a cup.
Some muffins and tea.
Bring me some.
What time do you call this? I said 1 o'clock precise.
I took an Eskimo device and didn't bike on the ice.
That's a fool's excuse. Who are you, Dr. Zeus?
It's true. Well, I'm here now, so let's make a truce.
Okay, sit down, shut up, I'll forgive you if you shout. And don't order marmalade, cause the cafe's all out.
Yeah, can you get the bill? Sorry, bro. It's a flag down the cab, I'm all out of dough.
Welcome back to Speak Up Kōrerotia. We're with Chloe Waratini, Bailey Perryman and Peter Langlands talking food in the city. And I'm your host, Sally Carlson. And we're going to pick up, we've just been discussing what is foraging. And I know that Chloe and Bailey, you've got some thinking around what foraging means, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the really exciting thing when I've been to different places and gone on foraging tours is suddenly you realise that you're surrounded by food all the time. You just didn't recognise it. And I think kids growing up these days, they don't really, a lot of them don't know that food comes out of the ground or off trees. And so getting them to have that awareness of that we're actually surrounded by things that we can eat and you kind of can't stop them growing in a way is really beautiful.
I dare say it's not just our kids as well. It's yeah. The adult population. And for me, it's the same principle, really. It's a thing about awareness and being able to see and read the landscape, like this concept of ecological literacy. It's the same with civics. I think people have been banging on about teaching civics in high school and things like that. But this, it's being able to understand political systems as well as being able to understand our ecological systems and understanding that those two are actually related and that our health is connected with that as well. And getting towards a more unified understanding of people and community and our landscapes, our habitat.
I had a really nice moment this morning. I was my veggie garden has gone to seed and so it's flowering at the moment. And some of what's flowering in there is Mizuno and it's got these beautiful yellow flowers. And then I was walking along the river near the Margaret Mahi playground and I suddenly saw a whole lot of it. And I was like, wow, there's Mizuno right there. A whole big patch of it. Where did that come from? You know?
Yep. And is it likely to have been someone sort of planted it or it's just self-seeded?
Birds, windblown.
Yeah, it's hard to know.
We get a lot of self-seeding of forage foods, especially along coastlines and edge environments. You'll find a lot of escaped basically seeds from people's gardens and have gone feral. It's pretty exciting. For sure.
And I think that's where you find, I've been reading recently around a concept of restoration agriculture. Mark Shepherd in particular from, I think it's Wisconsin in the States, but he really is thinking about the resilience of the plants, our plant communities, the ones that we actively cultivate as well. And it's in these edge environments that we just leave to waste as such, where you find the most, the toughest pest and disease resistant, productive, vigorous species that perhaps are the ones we should be cultivating rather than. But those edges at the same time, they're places where nature can do its own creative exploration around what works and what doesn't, and plays out the whole succession thing.
I think the edge environment thing's really exciting. In Canterbury, you know, we've lost a lot of edge environments, especially with the intensification of agriculture, and I know Environment Canterbury have finished doing a big GIS mapping exercise and just highlighting the amount of marginal edge environments that have been lost just in the last couple of decades has been quite outstanding, quite astounding, sorry. But so we really are, you know, foraging. The best areas for foraging are the areas that are most biodiverse. And for me, being a keen sort of bird watcher and researcher, I'm often spending time in those environments with work. So it all just starts linking in together, and you really just become in tune with the whole ecology. But it is, I think, a lot of it's about diversity, keeping that diversity in our environment. And cities are amazing environments for diversity, just by the nature of everyone's gardens.
Absolutely. A lot of edges as well.
A lot of edges. And then banging on that, we've got Banks Peninsula, which I think is one of the best foraging zones in New Zealand, just because of the sheer diversity of landscapes and microclimates. A lot of native and a lot of introduced species. A lot of species have their southern limit on Banks Peninsula, like kawakawa and things like that. So, yeah, it's just all about diversity.
We've been talking quite a bit about the unique, I suppose, biodiversity of Canterbury, and I guess if we're looking at Christchurch as a city, have you noticed people's attitudes changing over the last, I guess, few years to concepts of urban food and, I guess, particularly foraging and farming?
I'm quite new to Christchurch. I've just been here less than 2 years. But one of the things that I was really excited by when I first arrived was going along to one of the Food Resilience Network meetings and seeing how much momentum was happening there and how many diverse people were engaged. There were people there from council, there were people there from the DHB, there were guerrilla gardeners, there were chefs, there were farmers. And they're all working together, and I was like, wow, this is totally amazing. This is what I've been looking for and what I was trying to get up and running in Auckland, and which is where I was previously. And so I feel like the earthquakes have been a real stimulus in Canterbury becoming a real leader in New Zealand in this kind of consciousness around food. And the chefs that I talk to as well say that Christchurch is the most exciting place in New Zealand to be working because of that local food ethos.
Mm. Well, within 500 metre radius now, and just north of the river around Peterborough Street, you have three urban farming projects.
Yeah.
And it's quite amazing, really, when you think, sure, they are transitional, which is fantastic, but 500 metres east is the beginning of the residential red zone. And that's no doubt a place where these initiatives can take root a lot deeper, literally, and also closer to suburban populations. Bring this, and there are pockets like that all throughout Christchurch, where effectively we, on a global scale, there's interesting. Some interesting research being done on this now, contextualising this to Christchurch. We are a rural town, in a small scale with a low density. Mm. So urban agriculture there's so much space for it and so much opportunity, and the intensity of production that you can get, given the diversity of the landscape, opportunities and those edges, with the very beginning of something that I think will be become a really attractive part of the city in the long run.
Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, Christchurch was designed as a garden city, and which is a model that came out in the early 20th century to combat the ills of industrial pollution and give green spaces to give people, you know, the health in the city. And I really think have thought a lot about what is a 21st century garden city, and to me, with the you know, with climate change and food miles and carbon and all of that kind of stuff, having a city that feeds itself seems to be the ideal thing that a 21st century garden city would do.
And it's also the opportunity for people to carve out a livelihood doing this.
Yeah.
There are so many people who come to us every week who not only will just who will give their time and volunteer, but we can reciprocate because we're producing at that intensity. At the very least we can do is put on a lunch and send people home with a bag of something nice. But increasingly we are able to offer employment and say it's the Wild West effectively for innovation in local food is because there's so many opportunities from you could just specialise in making salsa or, you know, there are so many different options. And so the people we're working with now, we kind of just say, what's your wildest dreams and how can we support that? And let's start today with...
It's getting really exciting with forage foods as we go into different ways of preserving, you know, fermenting, just store all the sort of derivatives, things we can do, and it's pretty outstanding. There's a book that's come out called Wildcrafted Cuisine by an American author, Pascal Badot, and it's just a seminal work of what you can do as far as, you know, preserving, fermenting, processing wild foods goes and just the diversity of flavours you'll get from an already very diverse food base. We've got over 2,500 species of wild food in New Zealand at least, and we're still counting and finding new things. So it's just all about that diversity, all about the health. And, yeah, I think a lot of the food thing is about getting into diversity back. And, you know, when we've got living in a country where the government agenda is to double dairying in 10 years, we're running against that sort of tide of economic push. And I think a lot of people are feeling quite disenfranchised now because we're seeing massive water quality issues taking place with groundwater resources. And we're losing a lot of environmental diversity. I've driven across the Canterbury Plains and you'll just see shelter belts that have been bulldozed into piles and you'll see all these, you know, smoking piles of massive amounts of carbon going into the atmosphere and, you know, lots and lots of shelter belts being ripped out. A friend of mine who's a arborist, he just ripped out a whole lot of sweet chestnut trees recently, you know, and it's so we're... You know, with this government agenda of just intensifying and doing a bulk product, you know, it's, I think a lot of people are getting quite concerned about it now.
It seems to me like, and this is someone looking very much from the outside, I'm not in the food network, I guess. Yeah. It seems to me like people are, I think as a result of that sort of what you're talking about, the economic, that kind of push for... agriculture on a great scale, but also I think the earthquakes as well and that realization of the power of the individual to look after themselves. And I guess it kind of ties into the growth of things like farmers markets and organic produce and I guess for me that's kind of like almost like a middle class neoliberal movement as well, and like, I guess there's some sort of tension there maybe.
There is. It's a very polarised situation, in all honesty. I mean, you know, it almost feels like a form of warfare at times, you know, like guerrilla gardeners and things like that, you know, it's all go. You know, we're living in a very, you know, a polarised world. You know, the government wants to really streamline food production into a very narrow base to increase taxation and revenue and to have it all clearly defined. A lot of people go out foraging or involved in community gardens, the government realistically potentially is going to miss out on a lot of tax revenue. And, you know, a lot of businesses and things are involved in setting it up so everything's kept streamlined and it's all about, you know, money. And it's far more about money is, you know, people's mental health, people's physical health, people being able to experience the diversity of food. You know, we've got some absolutely horrific things happening with food at the moment, especially even, it's a bit of a sort of detour, but with seafood, you know, we've got seafood that's caught in New Zealand waters and then exported and reprocessed into new products and then brought back into New Zealand. And if you go to a supermarket in New Zealand now, a lot of our seafood's actually imported, which is just absolutely ridiculous. We've got one of the best diversities of high-quality seafood in the world, yet for the bulk of our people, we're importing fish. And the food miles are absolutely astronomical. There's issues with slavery on foreign fishing boats as well. Lots of human rights issues. So for me, when I'm out foraging, I like to take a fishing rod and just catch some fish locally and fresh. I know I've caught the fish where I've caught it from. And just last night I was fishing on the wharf at Port Levy and just fried up some mullet on the wharf. And, you know, it's a really satisfying and empowering feeling, being able to go out and get your own food or grow your own food. And especially if it's with other people as well, because there's a collective knowledge which is shared.
That's beautiful. Okay, it seems like a good point to have your song, yeah. Actually, Peter, George Harrison.
Oh. Cheers, thank you. Cloud Nine.
Have my love, it fits you like a glove. Joy my dream, tell me yes. Bail out should there be a mess. The pieces you don't need are mine. Take my time, I'll show you cloud nine. Take my smile and my heart, they rose from the start. Pieces to meet are mine. Have my love, use it while it does you good. Share my highs, but the times that it hurts, pain on mine. Those pieces you don't need are mine. I'll see you there on cloud nine.
Welcome back to Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. I'm your host, Sally Carlton, and we're on Plains FM 96.9. And we're going to pick up talking about food justice, and maybe, Bailey, you can kick us off here.
Yeah, I think continuing on with that line of inquiry, I guess, we're just acknowledging that food justice, food sovereignty, and in simple terms, the right for people to have a connection with their source of sustenance and to cultivate that. I think it's something we're definitely aware of and doing our utmost to put in place kind of structures and systems and ways of working together, which I learned through my time doing community gardening, but wanted to take to a level where it was, A, it's right, it's kind of riding out the end of our current financial system, which we know is flawed, and doing the best we can to use those resources now to set up a system which is going to support a cooperative food commons regime rather than an industrial corporate food regime. And within that are people. And that's basically every day when we began, say, for example, when we began down on the Peterborough site, there was already a community there, although the space may look vacant and neglected or whatever, there was a community who used that space and who continue to use that space with us there doing what we do. We coexist. And it's purely, and these are supposedly the disenfranchised or the disconnected or socially isolated people of our community, homeless people, our street-based communities and workers, and they're still, we have a fantastic relationship with them and they work alongside us. We always encourage them to come and take food whenever they like, and even create spaces within our farm environment, which is constantly adapting, but we accommodate that. And it's that, we could be on that whole gentrification buzz and land values and all that kind of thing. But that's the tightrope we're walking, because land values in other areas where urban agriculture has taken off, land values increase. But we want our staff, for example, to perhaps even be living on site or in the neighbourhood. The farm needs immediate and constant 24/7 care and attention, particularly if you're going to introduce animals. And who of our relatively low income staff, including myself, there's no way we're going to look at affording housing in the East Frame or somewhere like that where residential land is being developed, acquired and developed. Again, coming back to that point earlier, we said that our health system, our political system, all of it's interconnected. Housing is the biggest barrier for cultivate now. It's not for the lack of land or productive potential for support. It's actually about busting through a critical mass related to our livelihoods. And, yeah, we're butting up against an economic paradigm which doesn't acknowledge the value of our foraging environments, where our food comes from, the people who are involved in that process. So food justice is fundamental to what we do, to the point where we don't even name it. It's just inherent.
And with the Otakaro Orchard project as well, like that's, it's going to have a building on it, but it's going to be a half an acre of productive land with an orchard on it, with vegetable beds, all of that kind of stuff. None of it's going to be fenced.
No.
And there's been, the Food Resilience Network has been working with the council over the past couple of years to try and help them feel okay about having food in public parks, in the public realm. And there's all of these things like, you know, what about rats? What about, oh, people will just come in and steal. They'll throw food at each other rather than eat it. And it's just all of these things are barriers that we're having to overcome. And by having this really high-profile center city example of having edibles as a basis for beautiful landscaping as well and recreational space actually works. That's one of the like core purposes of that project as well, is to be an exemplar and a precedent in that area.
When we first became transitional custodians, I like to say, stewards of the Peterborough site, and one of the neighbours were doing the rounds, this sort of door knocking, one of the neighbours said, oh, there's a lot of delinquents that move through this site, and we've come to know those delinquents, and they are so respectful, and despite all the activities which that are going on all through the night and 24/7 basically, they tidy up after themselves. We hardly ever find any rubbish, and you know, that's a it's just not an issue. And people ask that question of, do you have any problems with people taking food? It's like, well, that's why we're there. Yeah. And if somebody doesn't feel safe enough to come in while we're there and join in what we're doing and take the food, then actually we've got to look at ourselves and say, what is it about this space which makes somebody feel uncomfortable to the point where they don't want to come in while we're here? They would rather come in and take while we're not there. And we're totally fine with that because we are producing food for our community in simple terms. And, we've really got to... There's no way we're going to be putting up barbed wire fences or anything like that. Like, it's, we've got to look at ourselves and how we create an atmosphere and environment that's warmly open, inclusive and safe. And
I mean, the best security is connection and increasing stewardship within the community that's there. And so that's what I think all of these projects have in common.
Well, you know, for sure, especially with, you know, foraging and that, it's just brings people directly into the environment, and there's really no better measure of the quality of the local environment than to be able to forage from it. Mm-hmm. And I think local councils might be challenged by the fact that lots of people will be out there potentially getting food, but then that puts the onus back on the council to make sure, you know, we look after the quality of our environment. And I've been involved a lot with recreational fishing. We used to have a lot of major water quality issues with the Lower Waimakariri River, which is an amazing area for Mahinga Kai, one of the most productive rivers in New Zealand, diverse whitebait, karawai, trout, salmon fisheries, flounder fisheries. And it was only really for fishermen, people being out in the environment, you know, that local authorities are often made aware of environmental issues. It's a bit of a vexed one, but overall I'm in favour of whitebaiting because, again, it gets people out on the local rivers and streams and at least tunes people into the quality of the environment. And I like to really have that sort of direct sense of connection. It's been challenging for me at times, though. I've been involved a lot with Forest and Bird, and they seem to have a policy. Well, I don't know how they stand on foraging, you know, but for me it's that environmental awareness is really important. And, you know, just getting people out. And there's some harvesting, there is some impact on environmental resources, but overall a lot of it's very sustainable. And with foraging, we're lucky because we've got such a diversity of species and locations that we can just basically skim the tip of the iceberg and not really have any major environmental impact.
Chloe, you mentioned the council being a little nervous about the Otakara Orchard. Is that partly because of legalities, do you think? Like, if we put these trees here, we're then responsible that...
Well, they're not putting those trees... and that's one of the things that's actually worked quite well and has been a kind of... a solution to putting trees, like productive trees, in public spaces is that the community stewards them rather than the council, and so the community buys them and looks after them. And there's a number of community gardens and orchards around the city that do have done that really successfully, and all of these examples are just helping to show, oh, this can be a really positive thing. And also, I mean, the residential red zone, I remember the past couple of years, once they opened it up and had mapped all those fruit trees, and you go out there on the weekend and there's lots of people walking around and cycling around, and it's almost like a treasure hunt.
Yeah.
Because you're like, oh, what have you found? And sometimes, you know, I ended up chatting to someone and he's like, well, I live in town and I've got this grapefruit tree and I don't eat grapefruit, you know, would you like to come over and grab some? And they'll give me some seedlings as well, and then the next week I'll drop in some other seedlings of something else to him. And like those kinds, that generosity that seems to be around food and foraging is so beautiful, because it's the opposite of stranger danger in a way. And it's... it just shows, like, you know, I would rather trust people first and trust that they're good people. And food just seems to be a way of, and cultivating food together, foraging food together, sharing and eating food together, just seems to be something that promotes trust and generosity in a way that I haven't seen with any other community activities.
And I think it's easy to understand why, and it's only really within the Parks and Reserves Unit Council, and I don't I don't want to point any fingers or lay any blame whatsoever, because I can totally understand with their budgets being cut, they have a large undertaking in managing our parks and reserves, and the willingness is there to begin forming relationships with community groups.
Mm.
We've got it, we being the community, people out there who want to do these things need to demonstrate some credibility as well. I think there's a whole lot of responsibility that we need to take to show that we're not just going to chuck in a few trees and create a mess, which is going to ultimately add to the maintenance budget, which is already strained. So I can totally understand the situation. And I think everybody is getting onto that same page now. So it's like, okay, where do we need to invest in order to build the capability and build the capacity and demonstrate and just start with a few small pockets, you know? And yeah, I think it's going to happen. It has to. And if only because there's just so much more awareness now, which I guess answers an earlier question in this discussion about a change in the Christchurch community. Totally, there has been.
And it's it's part of a greater shift as well, I think, that's happened since the quakes of Christchurch citizens wanting to take greater ownership and agency over their urban environment and their neighbourhoods and everything like that. And that's why Festa is important, because, of course, Festa's been one of those things of, you know, the purpose of that festival is to get more people involved in city making and shaping and creating our urban environment and prototyping different ways to do that. And so food is an intrinsic part.
Yeah. I mean, and the we've developed with Cultivate is my third attempt in something which is consciously attempting to do urban agriculture. But it started within the context of creating something for Festa in 2013 with Jess Halliday. We developed Agropolis, and it was fantastic, and the learnings from that very much have been adapted and adopted within Cultivate. And structures like the Life and Vacant Spaces Trust give you that enough leeway to explore and experience and learn, but enough security as well to protect you in your failures. And the failure is inevitable. And at that point, we're really, it's about building trust, building experience, and learning and adapting. And that's what the transitional movement is about. And we're going to be doing it since year dot. We've been doing this as a civilization. And who knows where we're going, but I've got...
It's nice to think it's going to continue long term though, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, it's not temporary.
And, I mean, there's the transition from, you know, the earthquakes to, you know, creating a livable city again, but there's also the greater transition of like our economic paradigm and the butting up against the limits of our planet, of the resources there. Like there's a longer transition as well that's going to continue throughout our lifetimes.
Just to finish up then, have you got any thoughts on what people can do if they're interested in taking part? What kind of activities can they take part in Festa, these sorts of things?
Yes, I'll be taking out a foraging tour, working them with ground foraging tours in Littleton, and so we're we'll be running a foraging trip that people can come along to, and just looking at a wide range of farm environments in a close to the city and around the city. So
we're at Cultivate, we are developing a kitchen garden, and that is a place where we can explore all the different ways that everybody, whether you have just a windowsill or a lovely quarter acre or a lifestyle block or whatever, any little bit of space that you can grow food, and you can do it at little or no cost. And it's also a way, an opportunity for people to come in, see what we do at the Peterborough Urban Farm. And, yeah, so we'll be running kitchen gardening workshops with lots of take-home bits and pieces, seeds, seedlings, and holding a tour and a lunch.
And we can do a plug for it because we've maybe brought in some produce from the garden, which is sitting here in front of us right now.
Yeah, just briefly, I was expanding on what Bailey said. What I'm really interested with foraging now is actually collecting foraged foods and bringing them back into the garden, you know, and gardening with them as well. So some species like native celery you can grow, and it just takes the pressure of the wild resource. And so, yeah, you can just about that diversity, it really increases the diversity of what you can garden.
And the Otakaro orchard is currently surrounded on three sides by construction, so we can't, and it's mostly just a big pile of rubble still while we're fundraising to our garden and our hub. So we can't safely have anyone on the site during Festa, probably, but we are working for Lean Means, which is the major Festa event where we create a temporary city in and around the art gallery, that whole block. Take over that. We're working with some Masters of Architecture students from UTS in Sydney who are creating a bespoke dining pavilion for us. We will have a pop-up restaurant that night on Saturday the 22nd, partnering with Chef Alex Davies, who's been a real pioneer in using local foods here. And we're creating a dining experience where you've got the full food chain in one space. So across the pavilion, there'll be some food growing and then picking, processing, cooking, consuming, and then composting as you move through the experience. So we're really excited about that. And the pavilion that they create is going to be a big table and some other pieces that we'll be able to then take back to our space and use to host other events. So it's really exciting to be working with them.
They sound like three really good examples of exactly what you've been talking about, this fusion between environmental and social sustainability. Yeah. So very exciting. And thank you so much for taking the time to come and share your wisdom with us today.
Thanks for having
us. You're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
And for the listeners, don't forget to check out our Facebook page. We'll make sure we put up the links to your guys' Facebook info as well.
Cool.
Thanks, Ali.
Kia ora. Cheers. Thank you.
We'd like to say a big thank you, kia ora, once again to Cafe Prima for sponsoring this Food in the City show. And we've just got time now for Bailey's choice of song, which is Silver Spoon by Paul Kattner and Grace Slick.